Hello, this is Terrence McNally. It's over a year since the defeat of Trump and 5 years since his Electoral College victory. Here's my 2017 conversation with Naomi Klein, activist and author of No Logo and Shock Doctrine, about her book No Is Not Enough, written largely in response to Trump's election. Klein made clear even then that successful resistance would not be enough. We must seize this moment to pursue nothing less than the world we long for, successfully confronting climate change and inequality while rebuilding our sense of human community. In addition to no, we need to offer a compelling, inviting, and just yes. And that remains just as true today. Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'll be joined today by Naomi Klein, the author most recently of No Is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. After hosting and producing this show weekly for 17 years, I stepped aside a couple of years ago from recording new live interviews. Since then, I've dug into the archives to stream one of the relevant earlier interviews each week on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and podcasts of years of interviews are available to listen to anytime on iTunes, Podomatic, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same site. But following the election of Donald Trump, I cannot resist exploring the path forward in confronting him and his administration. So first off today, I want to offer you a few websites for information on how to actively participate in resistance to Trump and the movement toward a healthy, progressive future we so desperately need. And you can email me at temcnally@mac.com to get these websites and more. Indivisibleguide.com, very strong network of local entities affiliated with this. OurRevolution.com, which grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign, MoveOn.org, which has been around for years but is now uniting its virtual campaigns with on-the-ground work more actively, FiveCalls.org, which tells you what are the most relevant calls to your representatives that need to be made at a certain time, TownHallProject.com, which tells you when your representative might be holding a town hall locally, and CourageCampaign.org, which is primarily in California, but very big, active, also like Move On, moving from a focus on virtual to much more alignment with on-the-ground grassroots action. As I said, you can email me at temcnally@mac.com if you want more information on all of this. I've shared this on the show before, but my response to Trump's election was, once I got over the sickening feeling that he would make life harder for life itself, and the anger at how things I thought could have gone differently, was that this image, when a rubber band has been stretched almost to breaking, the bounce back goes way beyond where it started. And my hope in the darkness, to use a term of Rebecca Solnit's, was that we would not merely defend the status quo, but that the harsh and unexpected reality would incite people to be more bold and committed in significant enough numbers and with transformative results personally and as a society so that we end up way better than before the election. And I shared that with Naomi Klein when I ran into her in Mexico in February, and she said that was the message of the book she was rushing to write. Naomi Klein is an award-winning journalist, syndicated columnist, documentary filmmaker, and author, a member of the board of directors for Climate Action Group 350.org, one of the organizers behind Canada's LEAP Manifesto. Her books include No Logo, Taking Aim at the Brand Bullies, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate, and her latest, No Is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics, Winning the World We Need. Welcome, Naomi Klein, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, and it was great to hear that roundup of all that you've been up to and are steering people towards.
Very good. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So can you tell us briefly about your path to the work you find yourself doing today, and if along the way you mentioned mentors or turning points, moments of decision?
I'll try not to talk for too long.
but it's funny. Everyone says it, but it is a window for a listener into, wait a minute, you know, how did we get here?
Right. I live in Canada. I'm a dual American and Canadian citizen because my parents are both American. I was born in Canada. And I live in Canada because my parents decided that it was a country that reflected their values better than the United States. They came to Canada because my father didn't want to go to Vietnam. And then we moved back to the United States briefly. And because my father worked in healthcare, he had experienced the Canadian healthcare system as Medicare for All was just being introduced. And he, after having that experience and then going back to the U.S. health system, he decided, no, I want to work in a public healthcare system where you don't have to be rich to get sick. And so we left the U.S. because of the war, but we stayed in Canada because of universal public healthcare, you know, not just as a sort of bureaucratic service, but as a reflection of the values of a society. My mom is a documentary filmmaker, and she kind of had a similar experience where she was able to get funding to make radical feminist films, anti-war films in Canada, working for a public agency called the National Film Board of Canada. Whereas when they went back to the United States, she was literally working somewhere called Portable Channel because she was working out of a trailer. I guess, you know, you asked about formative mentors, and I think my parents both played that role for me very much, just in explaining why we lived where we lived. You know, the rest of our whole extended family was still in the United States, and we spent a lot of time crossing the border to see grandparents and aunts and uncles and so on. So it was a very much a cross-border childhood for me. But, you know, in understanding why they made the decisions that they made, first to come to Canada, then to return to Canada, these were really political discussions, you know, because it was about war, it was about militarism, it was about pacifism, it was about feminism, it was about the right to certain things, like decent health care. So I owe a great debt to them, I think, just in giving me a life story that I guess baked in some of the values that I've been trying to fight for, trying to defend in the writing I've been doing my whole adult life, starting with No Logo, which was a book about how corporations were taking over more and more public and communal space in order to embody this new idea that they were selling a lifestyle, selling an idea rather than a product, starting in the 1990s. And so in terms of the work I'm doing now, in trying to emphasize that Trump is not the crisis, but the symptom of a crisis, and that as destabilizing as his electoral victory obviously is, and dangerous as his presidency clearly is, it's not a bolt from the blue. It is the logical culmination of a great many dangerous trends in the culture, the rise of corporate power, the rise of these mega lifestyle brands, often built around an individual figure, obviously the refusal to confront the racism and misogyny on which the United States was built, and the connection between the economy we have now and those powerful forces that never went away. And I could go on and on and on. I hope that's enough to get started.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. We're obviously going to focus this conversation on the ideas in No Is Not Enough, because they also are the ideas, you know, that are in the culture, whether you'd written the book or not, in a way. But you make the point that in each of your previous books, you did years of research and planning. Mm-hmm. This one was published on June 13th, 7 months after Election Day. How did the experience of writing change for you? You make the point that Trump's election syncs well with much of your previous work, that he is the embodiment of No Logo. You could do an equation, No Logo plus Shock Doctrine plus This Changes Everything equals Trump. Were there some pluses to writing so fast?
I think so. But I also, you know, I certainly couldn't have written this book without that 20 years of research. And, you know, that's the foundation on which I was able to work at a speed that each of my previous major works I haven't been able to work at, because, you know, I write a new book every 7 years, and I joke that it's kind of like getting a PhD each time.
Sure.
Because I don't write the same book over and over again. You know, not to, you know, I mean, I think sometimes when you have a success in the publishing world, your publisher wants you to just basically, you know, change a little few things here and do it again. But for me as a researcher, I've always been driven by my own curiosity and sense of discovery, and so that doesn't work for me, and so my books have been very different from one another, and so my first work, No Logo, required that I learn a whole lot about something I hadn't studied in school, which was marketing. I mean, I studied philosophy and literature, and here I was, trying to understand the world of corporate branding and reporting from sweatshops around the world. And so it took me a long time to do the research and get confident enough to write that book. And then with The Shock Doctrine, it was a steep learning curve around neoliberal economics and the history of regions that I previously didn't know that much about. And that's why it took me 5 years of really immersive work, and This Changes Everything required a similar kind of immersion in climate science and reporting from communities most affected by that existential crisis. So, but this book is different. This book is building on that, and certainly I had blind spots that I needed to fill, and I was very lucky to be able to work with some really talented researchers who were helping me to fill in those blind spots. But I was able to work at a velocity I haven't been able to work at before, and with a tremendous sense of urgency as well, because I wanted the book to come out in time to be useful in the Trump era, and
yeah.
We don't know how long that era is going to last. And I also really wanted to get the book out before a major shock hits the United States under Trump, other than Trump himself, an external shock. I dearly hope that won't happen, but we live in very rocky times. I think it's pretty unlikely for any U.S. president to last their term without having to cope with a major, major climate disaster. This president is making disasters more likely by deregulating the financial markets or trying to, and obviously he's antagonizing the world in lots of ways that make terrorist attacks more likely. And so when I wrote The Shock Doctrine, The Shock Doctrine is about how figures like Trump and many of the people he surrounded himself with have systematically exploited moments of profound national trauma around the world to push through a very radical economic agenda to do away with democratic and constitutional rights and just ram through a very unpopular privatization, deregulation, really eluding agenda while people are focused on whatever the emergency is. I think we saw it in the United States after September 11th. We saw it in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. And these are some of the examples I write about in the book. And I really wanted to give people some tools to be more resistant to those tactics. And so I wrote it. I wrote it in a hurry, in a way that I haven't done so before.
Yep. And you, a really fascinating point I found was you make the point the progressives were winning both. And this is interesting, both before the non-popular vote victory of Bush and Cheney, there was a successful uprising at the WTO meetings in Seattle in 1999, in 2000, again, an electoral college victory that's not a popular vote victory for Bush, and then before the non-popular vote victory of Trump with the XL pipeline, Standing Rock, living wage campaigns, and so on. Could you talk a bit about that, how just as we're winning these elections happen?
Right, and I think you're right to emphasize the Electoral College as a victory as opposed to the popular vote victory, because I think that is one among many tools that are that are deployed to suppress democracy. And what I describe as the shock doctrine is really a democracy avoidance strategy. It's using the dislocation, the trauma of an emergency, and the fact that people are rightfully focused on keeping their families safe, on the demands of an extreme situation, to go like, okay, well, while no one is looking, let's privatize the school system or the water system. And I've seen this again and again and again. There's little more anti-democratic than that. And so I think from voter suppression, to the Electoral College, all the various tools of voter suppression to the Electoral College, the right is constantly deploying strategies to prevent majority rule, right? And the reason for that is that their agenda, while it has a few popular items in it, everyone likes a tax cut.
Yeah.
Is generally really unpopular. People will defend their Social Security. They will defend the public health care that they do have, however incomplete. They will generally defend hard-won labor rights. And so it is because this is an unpopular, undemocratic agenda that these policies are deployed. But, in answer to your question around, putting these electoral setbacks, however undemocratic they are, in the context of a progressive momentum, it's absolutely important to remember that the climate justice movement ahead of this election was scaring the hell out of the fossil fuel industry, from the divestment movement to the anti-pipeline movements that were clocking victories, like against the Keystone XL pipeline, and also the fact that ExxonMobil was under investigation by the Attorney General of New York, California, the SEC, for having known about climate change, done its own research in the 70s and 80s, and then poured money into the denial machine, misled the public, misled its shareholders. To go from that to having the CEO of Exxon as the Secretary of State is pretty incredible. Or the Sanders campaign itself, and the fact that Wall Street was pretty panicked to see this figure, who they had been sort of dismissing as a crank, suddenly able to attract 13 million votes in the primary and come within an arm's reach of leading the governing party, then the governing party of the United States, which would have made him an incumbent candidate, right? So that was terrifying for Wall Street. And now where are we? Trump has basically outsourced the government to Goldman Sachs after running a campaign promising, to take them on and saying he was different from Hillary Clinton and Ted Cruz because he wasn't in the pocket of Goldman Sachs. So it's pretty incredible. The fight for 15, winning at the state level, forcing the Democratic Party to adopt its demand in the platform, even if it was dragged kicking and screaming. And then you have Trump. Remember his first pick for labor secretary, although it was stopped, and that was one of the early victories, was Andrew Pudzer, the CEO of the company that owns Carl's Jr. and Hardee's, which is one of the worst employers in the United States, has been sued multiple times by its workers because it failed to pay for overtime, failed to take harassment seriously, and on and on and on. And Pudzer himself was one of the industry's most vocal opponents of living wage campaigns. So you go from this movement that's on a roll to a president that would appoint their arch enemy as labor secretary. I mean, this is incredible what has happened in a matter of, as you said, 7 months.
And what people have, what I think the point you make and why I bring it up early in this interview is people have to remember that progressives were winning.
We haven't even talked about Black Lives Matter and the Dreamers.
That's right.
And the way in which national conversations had, were completely changed.
Exactly. And that things were coming together, that people were, where the Democrats, it's so funny to know who we are, but the Democrats are criticized for single issue campaigns and so on. But there was a thing where Black Lives Matter and the Dreamers and the Living Wage campaigns and the Bernie Siegel campaign were beginning to see things together and work together. And we have to remember that we were very close. There were only two candidates that were drawing 25,000 people to arenas. And had one of them been the candidate and won, the conversation would be so radically different than it is.
It's true. I mean, these are, this is the history that might have been. and so I think one can be just incredibly sad and discouraged by that or energized by it because, this possibility that it could have been Sanders running against Trump, that a winning progressive coalition could have been woven in time, to win, right? That's not a possibility that I have ever had in my adult lifetime. I mean, that's not a possibility I've ever entertained, right? Because I grew up in the neoliberal era. I'm in my 40s, and I grew up with Thatcher's "There Is No Alternative," and having it pounded into my brain that the values that leftists believe in are completely out of step with popular opinion and really don't bear mentioning in public or in polite company. And here's Bernie Sanders attracting those massive crowds, talking about free college education, universal public health care, challenging militarism, and the crowds are cheering.
Yeah.
So something is shifting, and what this means is that if we came that close,
yes,
then this is no time to be discouraged. This is the time to redouble our efforts and then some, and figure out how we win next time.
Yeah, it's interesting for me. I certainly had the same feeling with the Sanders campaign, that it's like, wait a minute, there's a candidate who actually, I would say exactly what he's saying. I am a generation older, and actually did my first work on the in politics on the national staff of the McGovern campaign, and then there was Robert Kennedy, and it had been that long since we'd seen a candidate that was saying what we could say. I want to shift the conversation.
But I just want to say before moving on is just that one of the things that I do in the book is as much as I love Bernie Sanders and supported him. I don't think that we have the time to waste to just go on and on about how Bernie would have won, and curse the DNC for the unfairness and all of that, because Bernie didn't win, and I think that his supporters can no more just heap the blame for that on the DNC than the DNC can heap the blame for their loss on the Russians. This is a moment for deep introspection and self-criticism. And, the fact that Bernie was unable to reach a significant percentage of Black and Latino voters who were not millennials, the fact that he was that a lot of women of my generation and older felt that he didn't get the importance of gender equality, and felt that sort of issues around racial and gender and sexual identity felt tacked on in the campaign, whether or not that's true of Bernie, that those were legitimate reactions. And this is part of what the mistake that cannot be made again.
Exactly. Yes.
Alicia Garza, one of the founders of Black Lives Matter, often says, "Let's make new mistakes." And I think that's something that the left really needs to take on board. Like, we can't keep, planning the campaign and then being like, "Oh dear, it's all white people. Let's go reach out to some people of color," and then be surprised that they feel tokenized and that their issues are not baked into the campaign, right? I think one of the best quotes in "No Is Not Enough" comes from Michelle Alexander, who wrote The New Jim Crow, and she basically said, if a progressives can't get it together on race, they better have Elon Musk on speed dial because we're going to need another planet.
Yeah.
And so I think we need to part of figuring out how we win next time means doing a lot better on race and gender.
Right. And what you're saying is rather than be discouraged and depressed, it's what are the lessons learned? And just as one could say, had Hillary done this differently, the turnout would have worked in Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, et cetera. Yeah. The same one can say for Sanders, had he from the start been able to speak to Black and Latinos and the disaffected women, then his turnout might have made him the candidate. And so
you gotta
learn your lessons. Hello, this is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my 2017 conversation with Naomi Klein, activist and author of No Logo and Shock Doctrine, about her 2017 book, No Is Not Enough. I want to take a big shift here, Naomi, and because it was, for me, the most meaningful section of the book, and you'll understand what I mean. And for you, I think it was a very important thing right at the process of the beginning of the book. Talk about your visit to the Great Barrier Reef, including the part about your son, Toma.
So I was in Australia in November of 2016 for a month, and I was doing some speaking and doing some reporting, and I, while I was there, made a short film for The Guardian about the Great Barrier Reef, which had just undergone this cataclysmic mass bleaching and die-off. And the situation has actually gotten even worse. And so as I was discussing this film and how to make this film with The Guardian, I realized that that for me, the visiting the reef was completely tied up in being a mother, and being a parent of a then four-year-old child named Toma. And that there was something feeling dishonest about making a film about the reef that was not about that. And I often struggle with this as a climate communicator, as somebody who writes about climate change and gives a lot of speeches about it, that there's a way in which when we talk about climate change, it can seem very distant and very almost bloodless. And you know, there's so much bureaucratic language surrounding climate, whether it's the scientific language or whether it's the language of the United Nations and the, you know, acronym regurgitation that goes on. You know, it's like the UN is where acronyms go to die. And, you know, between that and then you've got like the policies, which are just a nightmare of bureaucracy of like cap and trade and feed-in tariffs. And, you know, when you add up the science and the UN jargon and the policy jargon together, it's very, very hard to talk about this in a way that reflects the fact that we are talking about the dying of so much of life on Earth, and indeed the threat of that we are losing a habitable planet in the lifetime of our children. And so I've been trying to figure out as a speaker and as a writer how to write about climate change in a way that reflects the depth of the grief and the fear and the trauma of what it is that is being talked about, and that doesn't have all of this distancing language weighing it down. And so I made this decision to make the film about what it feels like to visit this magnificent part of the world, one of the seven wonders of the world, a World Heritage Site, the largest living structure on the planet that is the Great Barrier Reef, with a child who is too young to appreciate it, right? I mean, he doesn't swim well enough to snorkel. And I'm lucky enough to have grown up with a father who taught me how to snorkel by, you know, age 6 or 7, and had that experience, and it really transformed my life. And knowing that because of how rapidly climate change is unfolding, my son may miss this. By the time he's able to swim well enough, it may all be dead. And that's just an incredibly painful thing for us to realize, and it's just one tiny glimpse into the way we are failing in our most basic duty as parents, which is to protect a safe future for our kids. So we went to the reef together. It's very important for me not to to scare him. I was careful about the way I talked about it in front of him. And he was able to see some of the coral that is still alive, and we didn't take him out to the parts that were dead or explain to him how serious what was going on. We said that the coral was sick, was all that we mm-hmm. said. But I included it in the book, I guess, as it relates to the moment we're in. We rushed to get this little film out on the eve of the election. It posted November the 7th. and we were hoping that just this, that this would be one extra motivator to get people to the polls was why we rushed it out, just in terms of understanding the climate stakes. I wasn't a big fan of Hillary Clinton's, but I certainly was very clear that she was better than Trump. When it came to climate, you mentioned I'm on the board of directors of 350.org. We were in the planning stages for how we were going to put a huge amount of pressure on Hillary to do better than we believed she would do on her own, we knew she would need a whole hell of a lot of pressure from the outside to have climate policies that were in any way in line with what the science is telling us we need to do. So we rushed it out. And then I guess having just so recently had that experience, and then the Trump victory felt like everybody felt that the consequences on many different levels, and this was one of the levels I felt it on.
Yeah, and there is that one moment which, as you're tucking Toma into bed the day after he has been out to see the reef, I'm forgetting the words exactly, but you asked him about if he saw sort of the magic of
the secret magical world beneath the sea.
Yes, and he. See it, I'm tearing up now. And he says, yes, I saw it.
He saw it. Yeah, he saw it. And I mean, yeah, and he did. He caught a glimpse of it, And think about it, for a child. I mean, you look at the surface of the ocean, and it's hiding so much, It's placid, and, that part of the world, it's spectacularly blue. And then you put on this face mask and you look down, and it's this riot of color and life, and look at the secrets it's holding. It's magic, and at the same time, the ocean also has these terrible secrets that it holds. Right? I mean, I remember covering the Deepwater Horizon disaster,
yes.
And as the oil sank because the dispersants were. Sprayed so that the oil would sink to the bottom, and suddenly things started looking fine again, and everybody started forgetting. And it's like, well, it's still there, it's still in the bottom of the ocean, and the ocean, can look healthy on the surface as it does, still does, in the Great Barrier Reef, and underneath, in so many other parts of the reef, you put your mask on, and what you see is death and decay, and one of the most beautiful parts of the world turned into one of its ugliest, to be honest, because when coral dies, it's just rank.
Yeah,
it's not,
as you said, it's
ghostly white stuff you see the images of. It's rotting life.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to stick with the sea for a second here and read you a quote, which I think I found probably within the last year. And it's by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. And it's this: if you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. And my question has been, since I saw that, is how do we do that in 2017? How do we come up with a compelling narrative that drives Americans to yearn for a future richer than that past they're nostalgic for?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I know that for you, this is a crucial piece of getting beyond no.
Yeah, yeah. And the final chapter in the book is about an attempt I've been involved in called the Leap Manifesto to to get to that place, to paint a picture of the world beyond just fighting defense, beyond just fighting against things getting worse, which, you know, you've got to fight for, right? You know, when millions of Americans stand to be losing their health care, you have to fight that. But where you end up is not good enough if you win that victory. It's and that's true on so many issues where people are being forced into these defensive battles. And so, you know, what we did with the LEAP Manifesto, this is a project that started in Canada. There's a lot of interest in the States right now and in other countries, including Australia. And if people want to find out more about it, because I'm sure I'll do an incomplete job of describing it, they should go to theleap.org. A couple of years ago, we were part of convening a group of movement leaders from many different sectors, food justice, climate justice, indigenous rights, labor, faith, feminism, very broad group, green tech. And we locked ourselves, 60 of us, in a room for 2 days and did something that we realized we'd never done before, which is try to agree on our yes, on the world we want. you know, we'd come together, various parts of this kind of coalition had come together in coalitions of no. No, we don't want this new free trade deal. No, we don't want this austerity, you know, law, this austerity bill. But we hadn't come together in that sort of positive space. And because there was very strong representation there from indigenous communities, the immigrant rights community. There was a pretty strong no nostalgia rule, like, no, this is not going to be about white progressives just yearning for the 1970s when the welfare state was expanding, because these are communities that had never been included in that supposedly progressive past. We came up with what we call a people's platform, and you can read it at theleap.org. It's not long; it's 1,400 words, and it begins with painting a picture of the kind of country we could live in, but never have before, and it's, you know, it's been amazing the life of, and then it goes into 15 concrete things we have to do in order to get there, in order to get to 100% renewable energy, a transition in a way that puts the communities that have been most abused under our current economic system first in line to own and control their own renewable energy projects, with keeping the jobs and the skills in their communities, leaving no worker behind, so that as we transition from high carbon sectors to low carbon sectors, we are including the workers who are losing their jobs in the retraining and democratically participating in that. We also redefine what a low carbon job is, what a green job is, so that it isn't only the solar, you know, guys putting up solar panels and wind turbines, but it's also women taking care of the elderly and our kids, and this work that is overwhelmingly done by women, overwhelmingly done by immigrant women, that is so undervalued in our economy, that is low carbon and is never recognized as being a green job, but actually improves people's quality of life tremendously. You know, we make the argument that artists are, you know, low carbon workers, that public sector media is low carbon sector work. And then we, you know, lay out a plan for how we're going to pay for it. Because in a time of unprecedented private wealth, austerity is as we say in the document, a fossilized form of thinking that is at war with life on Earth. And the money is there. We just have to go after it, whether it is, increasing royalties on fossil fuel extraction, whether it is a financial transaction tax, a wealth tax. We worked with a team of progressive economists to cost it out.
One of the things that's a question, and if this is too in the weeds to really answer here, then just say so, but I've certainly been involved and am involved now in a group that's trying to say, okay, if we had clearer goals, if we had a clearer vision, that may be what's needed. How did you arrive at a set of 15 demands or goals in 2 days? How does that even happen?
Well, we went into the meeting with a draft, so we weren't starting from a blank sheet of paper.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very well moderated. We put a lot of work into how it was facilitated,
mm-hmm.
And the working groups and so on. And then out of that meeting, a draft was generated, and then it took a couple more months of consultation virtually after having that face-to-face meeting. And people being able to see how their words and how their work over those 2 days was reflected in the draft. And then so it took a couple months of fine-tuning the draft to get to a point where people were able to add their organizations or their individual names to it. And then eventually we had 220 organizations that signed on.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone from, you know, the largest trade union in the country to big green NGOs like Greenpeace and Oxfam to very small, like smaller and more grassroots groups like No One Is Illegal, Coast Salish Territory, Black Lives Matter Toronto, which is not a small organization, but is, you know, certainly more radical. So it did take time, but that face to face was important in terms of really grounding it and taking it to a completely unexpected place. I mean, it's interesting to me as a writer that the draft we brought in and the draft that came out of it basically have nothing in common.
Ah, I love that. So the preparation, the preparation is essential. The people had to arrive knowing that they kind of had a ballpark idea of where they were and where they were going. But the face-to-face interaction absolutely changes that, and people are good with that because they're owning it as it happens.
Absolutely. And I would say that the Indigenous leadership at the meeting was really, really formative in the language of the final document. We call it the leap, caring for each other and the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the way the meeting happened, I mean, we put a lot of work into facilitation. We had certain expectations, but the Indigenous leadership in the room also made sure that we began every day with ceremony, and that the some of the elders in the room led us in that. And I think that changed the outcome. You know, I'm not a religious person, but I'm really quite sure that having prayer in the space changed the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say exactly how, but I know it did.
By the way, I did not make it to Standing Rock, but all of the folks that I've spoke to in person who did say that that was also a key thing of the experience of that stand as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that it was held, if you will, in the womb of the Indigenous traditions and the sacredness of what they were about.
I think it changed how people treated each other. I wouldn't idealize it in either case, but it did change the spirit in which people approached conflict.
Okay,
in a lot of cases.
So the LEAP Manifesto dates to 2015, and yet I confess I hadn't heard of it until quite recently. As I began to look into your new book, and you made a joint appearance in the last few weeks with an L.A. City Council person, Paul Koretz, and kind of announced a goal for Los Angeles or Southern California. Could you talk just briefly about that?
Yeah, so it did start in Canada, so that's why you hadn't heard about it.
Right.
You hear too much about it.
Right.
The things you hear are very distorted. I believe that our Prime Minister is on the cover of Rolling Stone this week, as basically,
right.
Essentially, Bieber.
And we get a lot of we get a lot of comedians.
Yes.
And improv actors, yes.
So the interest in the United States about the LEAP Manifesto has really picked up since the election, and there's more interest in it at the local and state level than at the national level. I think, you know, what we were able to do in Canada would be very, very hard to do in the United States. That we were able to launch this national initiative out of a 2-day meeting. I mean, I think that it, you know, it's the population in the U.S. is so much larger. There's so many more organizations. I mean, just coming, like, who's invited, who's not invited? I mean,
yeah.
I thought it would be just such a, it would be so incredibly complex.
And then you actually had impact within the electoral campaign.
Oh, we did. I mean, we launched it in the middle of a federal election campaign as basically the platform that none of the parties were running on but should have. And that our political press didn't know what to make of it, but they were sort of fascinated by it. And why are you doing this in the middle of an election? You know, people were asking us for lawn signs. You know, it was an election campaign where a lot of people were voting for what they didn't want. We were trying to get rid of Stephen Harper, who was our prime minister
right.
for 9 years, very right-wing prime minister. And you know, even though Justin Trudeau is looked at in the United States as this huge progressive hero, in Canada he really wasn't seen that way. And there was a great deal of concern that none of the opposition parties, whether it was Justin Trudeau's party or the New Democratic Party, the NDP, they weren't running on campaigns that went deep enough on many issues, whether it was Indigenous rights or climate. So that's why we launched it in the election. And yeah, it changed the debate, forced politicians to respond to it. It attracted a huge amount of controversy. And, you know, the Green Party endorsed it after the election. The NDP, which had lost the election because a consensus or a critical mass within the party believed that it was because they had been too centrist and hadn't followed Bernie Sanders' lead
mm-hmm.
on running a really bold progressive campaign, then led a revolt within the party to endorse the Leap manifesto and spirit, and they got rid of their leader that had run this centrist campaign. So it has had a big impact on the debate. I won't lie to you, it's very controversial, and it's controversial because in addition to saying what we do want, we do say that we cannot build new fossil fuel infrastructure.
Right, right. That
is very controversial in a country that has bet on some pretty dirty forms of oil in the Alberta
yeah.
tar sands.
Yeah. And no, that I think you say no more fossil fuel infrastructure, that at this point any more is too
yeah.
much. And as one of Trudeau's weaknesses is he's good on some things, but he's very weak on fossil fuel infrastructure.
He is. I mean, he says lots of great things about climate change, but he wants to build several new tar sands pipelines.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. One thing that we don't have time to talk about, but I had thought about it a lot based on the book, and I just am going to mention, if you want a remark to it, you know, that's fine, which was one thing you write about is the opportunity missed in 2009 after Obama's election, that there was a uniqueness of that moment. A country widely hit up with a party that had suffered 9/11, invaded Iraq, crashed the economy. They elect an outsider candidate, a new race, a new generation, all of this. And at the time, I think I took each setback where he took halfway measures or he didn't go far enough or he didn't demand enough or he venerated bipartisanship in a foolish way, I felt. I didn't quite get the depth of how rare those opportunities are and how an opportunity like that almost has to be treated with the urgency of a crisis.
Yeah.
You want to
yeah,
speak
and I mean,
to
the opportunities being that he was able to write this massive check for a stimulus bill, $800 billion. It could have been more. After decades of relentless cutting back, you know, this idea that you could actually invest in the public sphere, that he was able to do that at a time when he was also, if he had chosen to, able to impose very significant conditions on the money that was being handed out to the banks in the form of a bailout. You know,
and the auto companies, as you point out.
And then the auto companies, right. So he had these three major economic engines in his hands, the banks, the auto companies, and the stimulus bill. And so, you know, I think it is worth imagining
yes.
what would have happened if we had really been able to break the neoliberal spell, which tells us that we should leave things to the market, and that, you know, despite the fact that the banks had driven themselves into the ground and that the auto companies had done the same, that really the goal of the government was just to get out of the way as quickly as possible again and step back and let them do their thing, which is what they did, you know. You know, what if there was not a fear of saying, no, this is what should happen? You know, maybe you should be making electric cars and subway cars. You know, maybe the banks should be forced to give you the loans to do it. And maybe the stimulus bill should be the glue that binds it all together. And that's how you have a real Green New Deal, right? Instead of just the rhetoric behind it. And so, you know, this is not about Obama bashing for me. This is about recognizing the incredible spell that neoliberal ideology has cast. And I believe that that is what is changing. I think if you look at the response to Sanders, if you look at the response to Jeremy Corbyn in the UK, who, you know, had, you know, we just came through an election that was supposed to wipe him out. If you look at every single poll ahead of the election campaign, and the election itself was called because his opponent, Theresa May, was so convinced that she was going to be able to just basically do away with the Labour Party once and for all. You know, they didn't need to call the election. They did it.
They thought the timing was right.
And instead, what happened is Corbyn released a manifesto that was so bold that it just captured the imagination of 40% of the country who ended up voting for him. So he didn't win the election, but he gained more seats than the Labour Party had gained in a single election since the Second World War. And Theresa May lost her majority. So it was a huge upset. And I think it shows that spell that is what prevented Obama from taking those actions in 2009 is starting to lift in the political sphere, that we are starting to see figures emerge who are not afraid of governing, you know, who are not afraid of doing the things that are necessary in the face of these overlapping crises of climate change, economic inequality, racial injustice. And, you know, I'm not saying that Corbyn has everything figured out or that Sanders did, but that willingness to get in there. And, you know, Corbyn, the centerpiece of his campaign is renationalizing the rails in the energy sector.
Yeah. And when Thatcher said there is no alternative, he says, yes, there is.
Yes, there is.
And the one thing I would say is the third plank, sort of, you're talking about, there's sustainability, climate change, there's economic and other sorts of justice. And then the third, really, I think the third plank, and then we've got to bring this to a close, is community. That somehow we have to restore the meaningfulness of people's community and connection so that they aren't distracted by consumerism and fear.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's maybe the most challenging part, you know, which is why, you know, as you know, I end the book with this call for us to kill our inner Trump. If you'll excuse the violent metaphor, but that this sort of, you know, that you know, I really think he should be metabolized as one would metabolize, you know, a really frightening dystopian fiction, you know, that when you read a book like Brave New World or Handmaid's Tale, what it's trying to do is hold up a mirror and say, this is where all roads lead to. And you look at this, you know, figure who can't remember what he said yesterday, can't read anything longer than a tweet, you know, and, you know, it's just so vicious. And I think if this is a moment to say, okay, well, what part of that culture is in me?
Mm-hmm.
And how can I change that?
Yeah. Okay, we've got to bring it to a close. The websites to learn more are naomiklein.org, noisnotenough.org, that's the name of the book, and theleap.org to learn more about The Leap. And I did speak with Anthony Rogers Wright about what's happening in the U.S., and I certainly invite people to go to The Leap website and learn about this and get involved. The book is No Is Not Enough, Resisting Trump Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. That's the yes. Thank you, Naomi Klein. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much.
For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TERRENCE, MCNALLY.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site or email me at TEMcnally TEMCNALLY at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, or at iTunes. Listen anytime, anywhere. Archives include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, etc., etc. Finally, thanks to Mark Maxwell in production at KPFK, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely.
Progressive Voices desperately needs your financial help. Please go to progressivevoices.com and press the donate button right now. Thank you.
Advertising has been characterized as rattling a stick in a bucket, a noisy cry for public attention. One example of this crass hucksterism is the rush by top executives of multi-billion-dollar corporations to splatter their corporate names on sports venues. Responding to a blatant scam by team owners, executives are spending absurd sums of their shareholders' money to win temporary naming rights to local stadiums, arenas, etc. The come-on is that this billboarding will buy brand recognition, customer loyalty, and even public gratitude for the purchaser. Seriously? Do you fly Delta, bank at Wachovia, or drive a Toyota because their names are on a big sports structure somewhere? And what do outfits like Ameriquest, Qualcomm, and FTX even sell? And where are they located? As for public gratitude, ask Houstonians how thankful they are that global energy giant Enron slapped its name on the Astros baseball park in 1999, just 3 years before the corporation was forced into bankruptcy for being guilty of massive fraud and squalid executive greed. But the bucket-rattling name game keeps drawing new players. The latest entrants are purveyors of cryptocurrencies, the phantasmagoric here-today-gone-tomorrow form of digital money. One of these, Crypto.com, has just laid out a ridiculous $700 million, presumably in real money, not cryptos, to put its occult brand name on the home arena of the Los Angeles Lakers. Why? The parties to the deal put it in grandiose terms. A match made in heaven, exulted the arena's giddy owner, even proclaiming that Crypto.com will, quote, help us chart a course for the future of sports. This is Jim Hightower saying, huh? I doubt that this cryptic Singapore-based money dealer can even dribble a basketball. It's just rattling the money bucket, turning sports into just another corporate money hustle.
Hey, Truth Seekers, Mike Malloy here. I'm the Progressive Voices program host each night at 9 in the East, 6 in the West. And I invite you to join me for the most intense podcast you're going to hear anywhere. I talk about the events that are having a profound impact on our lives, the lives of our families, and this country. For example, this time in our history is now being referred to as the post-Trump era. That's simply false. Trump's fascist followers will continue to assault the rule of law and inject violence into our daily lives until they're stopped. Trump's near destruction of our political system is going to take tremendous effort to restore. The hope is that in that restoration, we will finally address those issues of inequality under the law and construct a truly democratic system. And that's what I talk about each night. And I do so with the fervor of someone who believes in our founding documents, even though they were written by hypocrites. Join me for the ride, nightly at 9 in the East, 6 in the West.
Hey, it's Stephanie Miller. Here's what we're talking about.
Republicans are trying to protect your kids from wearing a mask or reading a book that might be accurate about history and give Jaden a sad about white people. And Democrats want your kids not to get shot to death in school,
right?
Or get die of COVID, which hundreds of kids have.
And then there's Dr. Oz.
I'm sorry, Jaden has been thrown out.
Poor Jaden.
I believe that was what Frangela used for the sad white kid. And I thieved right from Frangela.
It's fair. It's
That's
fair.
The douchey white kid.
I see.
That might get a sad because he learns that white people were mean to black people at some point in our history. Jaden, I hate him this morning. I hate everyone.
Jaden Smith, like
Except
Will Smith.
Your rack looks fantastic in that shirt.
I usually wear black on camera, but I decided to go out of my comfort zone.
Well, you look magical and fantastic. I complimented your ass when you wore spandex for Halloween.
I'm wearing short shorts.
Complimenting his
I got short shorts on today.
Oh,
people in for
stand
a good time.
Give the people something.
Oh, people in for a good time when I am plugging the software.
Give people something. Also,
stay tuned for my commercial breaks.
Here's the other good news. There are lots of bag of rats news. I'm sure the mainstream media will tell us why this means Democrats are in disarray. But holy, are the rats fighting?
Yeah.
Wow. Fight, fight, fight.
Girls, you're both awful.
God, you are both awful, mean girls. What? Who is in the girl fight now? There is a lot of hair pulling, a lot of slapping. Marjorie Taylor Greene, Ilhan Omar, then Nancy Mace got in there somehow. Lauren Boebert. Kevin McCarthy tried to pull them apart. He got slapped. His extensions got pulled out. Oh, my God. It's fantastic. They're all awful.
It's like a Real Housewives episode.
Yes.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Did someone throw wine in Kevin's face? Uh-huh. I don't even know.
Find the Stephanie Miller Show every Monday through Friday at 9 to noon Eastern, 6 to 9 Pacific, right here on Progressive Voices.